During the first 4 months of this year, 6 Americans were killed by terrorist action, and some 8 Americans were being held by terrorists in their safe houses and prisons. During that same 4 months, 15,000 Americans lost their lives in the highways of this country. And many Americans have recently been planning safe summer vacations by canceling their trips to Europe to take to the safe highways of this country. Now, I don't cite these statistics in order to suggest that terrorism is not a serious problem. It is. But simply to make the point that panic, a foolish reaction to a very real problem, is no answer. Obviously, I could have taken a different time frame and the statistics would not be as startling. Obviously, I would not now plan a summer or a winter vacation in Beirut. In Lebanon every day, some 20, 30 or more people are killed by terrorist violence. I do not mean to suggest that the United States risked over 200 of our warplanes and of our pilots and the major carrier task force simply because a single American soldier had been killed in a bomb explosion in a discotheque in West Berlin. My point is other. My point has to do with the simple truth that terrorism has been a fact of life ever since there is a historical record. After all, Cain was a terrorist when he slew Abel at the sacrifice. And that panic, the herd instinct, is the very thing that terrorists count on. After all, a bomb has a definite limit to its explosive power, and once it's been exploded, that's the end of it. What the terrorist counts on is the aftershock, how you and I, millions like us, will react. And their purpose, if there be a purpose to their actions, is to bring organized society to a standstill, to create the whole world, to turn the whole world into a Lebanon, where there is no law, no order, no security, no government, no possibility of carrying out the ordinary daily responsibilities of life with some degree of safety. And their means of achieving this is terror, which is simply the indiscriminate use of violence to some assumed end. And they count on the fact that we will panic, lock ourselves behind our doors, hunker down, be fearful of moving out, surround ourselves with such expensive security that we no longer have the wherewithal to provide for the decencies of our society. They count on our reactions, but most of all in the modern world, and this is why the power of terrorism has been multiplied in our world, they count on the media. If the terrorists commandeer a plane and no one reports it, the only people who are involved and know anything about it are the pilot and the passengers, and that's where it begins and ends. But when the terrorists skyjack a plane and crisscross the Mediterranean and put down in Tripoli and in Cyprus and in Cairo and in Beirut, and every action, every landing is photographed by the 100 cameras, and when they allow a few women and children off in Athens or a few more in Tripoli, and these are interviewed, all of this is reported immediately by the media. And as we saw last summer with the TWA hijacking, they can play out this drama for a week or two or more. And in so doing, they get their terror, their sense of purpose, whatever it may seem to be, across into the homes of the world. And then they can even hold before the cameras, a so-called press conference of their captives. That's what they're after. Insofar as terrorism has any mode of operation, it is that which is implied by the phrase propaganda by the deed. Perform a deed which is dramatic enough. The world will listen and will watch. And you will presumably have lifted up your cause, lifted up your purpose, whatever it may be. And there's a great deal of truth to this, and that is why the role of the media in this whole problem is so crucial. When someone comes to Cleveland to speak, again and again our papers, the evening news, will notice the protesters in front of the hall, and they'll fail to report a single thing that was said inside the hall. Well, look, protesters are not terrorists, but that need of the so-called news programs for that which is visible, which is dramatic, which is confrontational, which is of human interest because it involves captives and terror and fear. This voracious appetite of the media for this kind of material is one of the reasons that we suddenly find ourselves faced with a problem we call terrorism, even though I could take you through all of recorded history and show you that terror has never been absent from the human condition. Terror has always been present. Whenever people have felt abused or paranoid, or where they've had a pathological need simply to express themselves violently, there's been terror. There have been causes. There has been an attempt to impose the will of the few upon others. Now, terrorist counts upon two things. That the audience, you and I, will respond to what they proclaim to be their cause, and that we will agree with them that there is no other way to achieve their goals, whatever it may be, except through this kind of violence. That all other legitimate means have been exhausted. And nothing could be further from the truth. The prototypical terrorists of the 20th century were the Narodnaya Volnya, the so-called Freedom Brigade, who in the 1870s in Tsarist Russia began to assassinate ministers and police officers of the Tsar. This Freedom Brigade was composed of about 200 young people, most of them children of the very class that where they were attacking, who were expressing their anger against the repression of Tsarist policies. And my point is not that Tsarist policies were not repressive, but that Tsarist policies were on their way of being reformed. The serfs had already been freed in Tsarist Russia. Industrialization was making itself felt. The political changes were already in motion, which would lead to the first Duma, to the establishment of the first Russian parliament. But the young are impatient. The young are messianist. The young wanted to push freedom along, and so they resorted to violence. Now, when they did so, they pushed the revolution along. And when the revolution came and a true police state was established, there is no longer a Freedom Brigade. There's no equivalent of the Narodnaya Volnya in the Soviet Union today. Because when a state is truly a secure state, authoritarian, tyrannical, it can repress terrorism. Terrorism emerges only in those societies which are beginning to be transformed, beginning to liberate themselves, or in those which are, in fact, largely free. Terrorism exists in Western Europe and not in Eastern Europe. It is the plains of the Western nations which are being attacked, not Erflot. And so the assumption that there is no other way to achieve one's end is not necessarily a fact, nor is the corresponding assumption by those of us who are impressed by terrorism, who watch it, that if we could only remove the causes which the terrorists claim are the source of their anger, we would remove the existence of terrorism itself. The so-called Red Brigade, which began as the Biedermannhof gang in Western Europe, particularly in Western Germany, some 25 years ago, is in a sense the prototypical modern terrorist group. What is the source of its anger? The existence of government. All government. All government is assumed to be repressive. They intend to bring society to a standstill. How can one remove the cause of their anger? How could one have removed the causes of the Sibyanese Liberation Army, Charles Manson and his strange pathological group? Let me give you an example from our own history. In the first century before the Common Era, the Romans secured their control of the Eastern Mediterranean. And Pompey marched into Judea and secured the submission of the Hasmoneans. He established under Roman control a group of puppet emperors, Antipater and Herod, and then these in turn were supplanted by Roman procurators, people appointed by the Senate. Now, Roman rule was hard, Roman taxes were high. There were reasons for Israel to be restive under the Roman boot. And there arose in Judea in the first century of this era a group known as the Zealots. Their leader was a man named Joshua ibn Gamala. Now, the Zealots protested against Roman rule. Well and good. There were things to protest. But the theology, the conviction of these Zealots was something which was far wider. For the Zealots argued that according to God's will, according to the Torah, Israel was to be subordinate, to subjected to no one, to no human being but God itself. Only God was to rule. No government, no authority save that of God and God alone. Now, how could the Romans agree to that? They'd had to dismember their empire, and that wasn't about to happen. Now, because there was a streak of zealotry, of terrorism in this group of zealots, this group of Jews, they began to precipitate incidents, to throw stones at the Romans, to attack the Roman soldiers. And when the Romans began to suppress the zealots, the middle group in ancient Judea, you and I, began to protest. We began to point out to these people how futile their undertaking. It was impossible to achieve their end. Besides, it was only leading to the turning of the screw. The Romans made things worse and worse the more these attacks took place. And so what did the Zealots do? They began to attack their fellow Jews. And during the 40s and 50s and 60s of this first century of this era, more Jews were killed by these terrorist guerrillas than Romans. And ultimately, the great middle was silenced. And ultimately, the Zealots precipitated enough incidents that there was a massive eruption and a fatal rebellion against Rome in which 1 million Jews were killed, in which the temple was destroyed, in which Jerusalem was razed. Zealotry, terrorism, often has a root cause, which even if we could solve the problems of poverty or of colonialism, whatever be the problem they claim, could not be met. Those who have watched the spread of terrorism and who have seen that much of this terrorism has to do or originates in the Arab world, in Libya, Syria, Iran, Yemen, places like that, have decided, because the Arabs have suggested this, that if only there was a solution to the Palestinian problem, Western Europe, the United States, the free world would not have to worry anymore about the kind of terrorism that the TWA plane, the shipjacking of the Kilauea, the bombing of our embassies, American Express headquarters, Banks of England, and so on, represent. Now, we know that the attempted bombing of the El Al plane in London just 2 weeks ago was masterminded by Syria. There's a report in the New York Times this morning that indicates that the Syrian embassy official is the man who accompanied the Arab who gave the bomb to his pregnant sweetheart to put on the plane to London. And once the bomb was discovered, this great hero fled to the Syrian embassy. He was hidden there for 3 days until he left and was ultimately found and incarcerated by the British police. Now, the assumption is that Syria would not engage in acts of this type if it were not for the Palestinian problem, and since to some a just solution to this problem is the establishment in the West Bank and Gaza of a Palestinian state, there's a solution. We don't have to bomb Libya, we don't have to bomb the bases in Syria. All we have to do is to pressure Israel to create a Palestinian state. Now, what is faulty in this logic is that Assad and the Syrians have never said that their solution to the problems of the Middle East are the establishment of a Palestinian state in Jordan and in the West Bank and in Gaza. Quite the contrary. As recently as 3 weeks ago, Assad made the point that it would not be long before the Golan would be retaken, and it would not be the border of Syria, but be in the very center of Syria, implying that all of Israel, as well as the West Bank and Gaza, would be incorporated into his vision of a greater Syria. We have a way, because we seek solutions, to find solutions when none exist. The reason that the Arab world is attacking the West are far more complex than the fact that the West Bank is still under Israeli control. Fawad Ajami is a professor of government at the Johns Hopkins University. He was born in Lebanon. He is by inheritance a Shiite Muslim. He's also a very shrewd observer of the Middle Eastern scene, and he said some things which are worth listening to. No American diplomatic scheme would spare America the fury of those bent upon eradicating its presence in the region. It is a false reading to say that the terror springs from the impasse between Israeli and Palestinian. If Americans are to embark upon a diplomatic initiative, they must have no illusions about it. Their enemies in the region will go on a rampage precisely to convince them of the futility of such an endeavor. Middle East terror is rooted in the struggle over the sole and historic direction of Islam. The center is under siege by militants of every stripe. That is why, in a political world of angels and demons, the distant superpower was turned into a demon. A decade of oil wealth and promise in the Muslim world was ending in failure and defeat. When the inevitable scapegoating came, America was the best kind of scapegoat because it had become part of the region's landscape, its feuds, and its calculations of power. For Khomeini's followers in Iran, America stood for cultural defilement. For the Syrians, America was the one thing standing between them and regional hegemony. For the Palestinians, America stood between them and a Palestinian state. For Gaddafi, America is the symbol he can use to rally popular support despite being an isolated, hated figure in the region. What Ajami is saying is that there are issues within issues within issues, angers within angers within anger, roiling in the ancient Middle East, and that this world in turmoil and conflict is simply lashing out the way a child lashes out against parents and against the adult world when they're frustrated, and that no single solution will relieve the world for a long period of time of the danger of terrorism. And if you would understand this better, recognize that most of the world has tried to adjust to terror the way small shopkeepers in the United States adjusted to the mafia. That is, they paid protection money. France, Italy, some of the Low Countries did so simply by agreeing to turn a blind eye to the false passports which were bringing in the terrorists to Europe. And once in Europe, you can cross any border without a passport. And they were not searching diplomatic pouches, which they knew contained machine guns and grenades and plastic explosives and other weapons of this kind. They were being bought off and they were buying off. But those who had to buy off the terrorist at the highest price were not the Europeans, but the Arabs themselves. The Saudi Arabians have bought off the Syrians at the price of $1 billion of money given to the Syrians a year. They have given $750 million each year to the PLO. Now, why has Syria given this, has Saudi Arabia given this money to Syria and to the PLO? In order to provide security in their own country against the restiveness of the foreign workers who man the oil fields, who are doing the dirty work in Arabia, who could easily be mobilized by the radical forces, the radical ideas represented by Syria and by the PLO. You can't ultimately, of course, buy off the mafia, or buy off the terrorists. For ultimately, it becomes greed takes over. The tribute becomes higher and more expensive year by year. Demands become greater. For reasons which we do not quite yet understand, the Kuwaitis fell afoul of the Hezbollah, the Iranian Shiite terrorists. And a number of these terrorists came down with an attempt to assassinate the king and the nobility of Kuwait, and they failed in this undertaking. They were caught. And they've been in Kuwaiti prisons for almost 2 years now. The response of the terrorists to this was to begin to capture American professors at the university in Beirut and to hold them to try and ransom them by having the United States government pressure Kuwait, an oil-rich state, a feudal state, to release the prisoners. The American government tried and was unsuccessful. And so the Hezbollah, these terrorists, began to capture as French citizens, knowing that the French ties are deep with the Arab countries, that the French might be moved to be more determined in this effort. And they, again, the French were unable to secure the release of these prisoners in Kuwait. Now, France, of course, an election to a certain degree in France was determined by the inability of the French government, Mitterrand, to secure the release of the French nationals who had been captured in the Lebanon. But the more interesting question, the question that few have asked, is why did the Kuwaitis, Arabs, refuse to release these terrorists whom they had captured? Why, despite the entreaties of the United States, of Western Europe, particularly of France, did the Kuwaitis refuse to do this? And the answer is simple. Living in that part of the world, knowing the terrorists, the Kuwaitis know full well that if these men are released, Kuwait will quickly become the focus of other attacks, because the one thing that can increase the level of terrorism is a certainty on the part of the terrorists that they will escape whatever happens scot-free, that even if they're captured, they'll soon be released. The image is of Abu Nidal in Italian hands being released immediately because the Italians are fearful of putting him in their jails. But the Kuwaitis know that if they release these 18 or 20 prisoners, it will not be long before another 18 or 20 or 180 and 200 come down and attempt other acts of violence against their government. One of the myths of the West is that those who performed acts of terrorism, in fact, are putting their lives on the line for some cause which they hold to be sacred. The one truth is that these are not fanatics who are willing to sacrifice their life for their cause. They're willing to sacrifice the life of their pregnant Irish fiancée, but not their life. The Israelis 6 or 8 months ago captured 3 adolescents, car bombers, Lebanese, who had been caught driving cars loaded with bombs which were about to explode in southern Lebanon. And when these young people were interviewed, the story that they told was a very interesting one. They were not the Hezbollah. They were not the leaders of the of the terrorist group. They had been pressured to do this, either by being told by the leaders that if they would drive this car south, they would escape before it went off, and they would give to them for transmission to their parents desperately needed money. Or they were told, yes, they might become martyrs to the cause, but if they were, great advantage would accrue to their family, which was otherwise destitute. The terrorists themselves are very fearful of losing their lives. Their lives are as precious to them as our lives are to us, which is one of the reasons that many believe, including our own government and the Israeli government, that it's only by making the terrorists recognize the high cost which will accrue to them for their acts of violence that one can in some way suppress, limit, control the amount of terrorism which is abroad in the world. Yes, the problems of poverty, the problems of malnutrition, of inadequate education, lack of birth control, the problems of ignorance, all these problems must be addressed. But not because the terrorists tell us they must be addressed. They must be addressed because they are immoral, unfortunate, intolerable. But terrorism itself will not speed us on that journey towards the reform of the world. As a matter of fact, more often than not, terrorism simply impedes the journey. It creates the police state in response to its acts. More and more security, more and more barricades, more and more separation between the community and its leaders, more and more arbitrariness in the society. The Tupamaro in Uruguay were a group of young people who were determined to hasten democracy in that land, and they managed in the process to overthrow a democratic government and to bring about the reestablishment of a military dictatorship, a junta. When we face violence, we must recognize that those who commit the violence care about their lives, that they can be pressured even as they are trying to pressure us. But we must be willing to be constant. We must be willing to pay the price, for there will be a price. The United States has only lately come to the idea that there must be some way to make the nations of the world who engage in state terrorism pay that price. And we've gone about this inconsistently. As much as we've complained about the lack of support of our allies, I think we must recognize that we ourselves have not been of a mind. Yes, we embargoed the sale of goods from and to Libya. But we excluded from that embargo the property and the oil production of five major American oil companies: Occidental, Amerita Hess, Conoco, and others. And the argument which we used is really that the business of America is business. We didn't want them to be hurt, that they had $1 billion worth of investment. The result was what? The result was that a nice, symbiotic, sweetheart relationship had been established between these oil companies and Gaddafi's government. Gaddafi had a majority control of the operation in his own country already. He took 95% of all the profits that these companies made by bringing out and shipping to Europe and to the Middle East and to the Far East 500,000 barrels of oil a day. They were allowed a profit of 5%. But they were also taxed the 95% as taxes. And they were allowed by our own tax laws, these companies, to deduct those taxes from their profits made elsewhere in the world, which means what? That you and I, by our paying our federal income tax, we're making up for these taxes which were not being paid by the major oil companies, which were rather going into the coffers of the Libyans, and that we were in fact doing what? We were in fact buying the missiles and the guns and all that that Gaddafi was making. Now, by more recent ruling in the last week or so, these companies have to leave Libya. But we closed our eyes to the fact that 5,000-6,000 American oil people have been working in Libya despite a presidential order ordering them out. We made no attempt to enforce that order. And worse yet, when one looks at the arsenal that Gaddafi can throw around the world to sport, Much of that arsenal was bought for him by Americans, by ex-CIA agents, and by men who were working under the aegis of the CIA, who used that the advantage of their office to cloak what they were really doing. And one of these men, Wilson, is now in American jails. But again and again and again, when one looks at the international arms trade, we find that the countries like Syria and countries like Libya and Yemen could not buy sophisticated weapons from the West unless Westerners were willing to sell them. And there are simply Americans, Englishmen, Frenchmen, who set greed, profit above their concerns for the well-being of the world. Gaddafi and Assad are not the only ones who are guilty in this. Nor have we been consistent even in our approach to terrorism. Tip O'Neill's a lovely man, but Tip O'Neill's an Irishman. And the Irish vote in the United States has some degree of power. And so we have consistently refused to request from Great Britain to extradite to Great Britain known IRA terrorists, Irish Republican Army terrorists, who have escaped to the United States. And we've turned a blind eye to the raising of monies in the United States for terrorism in Ireland. And the Europeans quite rightly can point to our own inconsistency, even as we begin to lecture them and hector them about theirs. The world has not dealt with terrorism in all of its seriousness. There is as yet no defined code of practice for Western media, for the free media, and how to respond and not, what to do and what not to do during a terrorist attack. How should they respond? Should an NBC give prime time to an Abu Abbas to be interviewed, to have his filth spew out into American homes without any kind of commentary, background? I wonder. The West has been inconsistent. The West does have, within limits, the power to hurt the terrorists. We can capture those who operate on our soil. We can extradite, as Great Britain did this week, as Spain did this week, terrorists who are known to have used diplomatic immunity in order to achieve their ends. A new code of limiting the kinds of diplomatic immunity which should exist can be developed. Diplomatic pouches, diplomatic mail is immune. Well and good. But why must goods be immune? In this era of telegraphic, telephonic communication, why should we allow missiles to be put into diplomatic pouches and transported from Libya or Syria to Europe or to the United States without inspection? Good question. The world is going to have to come to grips with these for the coordination of intelligence, with any number of issues which they have been unwilling to come to grips with. And all of us must come to grips with a world which is far less secure than we'd like it to be. One of the things that the terrorists count on is that the West reveres, respects life, that will go to almost any length to protect the life of the innocent. But sometimes innocent lives have to be sacrificed in order that other lives may not be put in jeopardy. At some point, you cannot give in to the kidnapper and pay whatever ransom he demands, knowing that if you do, others will be kidnapped, that you'll simply accelerate the pace of terror in this world. Security has to be improved. All of us have to become more concerned with our own safety when we're in strange places. But we also have to recognize that there is no way for our government or any government to guarantee our safety day in and day out. We can't be guaranteed our safety here in Cleveland. We certainly can't be guaranteed our safety throughout the world. One of the complaints that was raised once Mr. Reagan ordered the attack on Benghazi in Tripoli was that it will only accelerate the pace of terrorist attacks against American citizens. Perhaps it will bring terrorism here to these shores. It may, no question.
Clearly, however, it has had at least this advantage, that as you read about the uncovering in the last week or two of Syrian, Libyan plots in Italy, in Spain, in England, in West Germany, in France, and the expulsion of a number of people, the incarceration of others, know that every one of these plots was known to exist before the American attack on Libya. What the American attack did was simply to force these countries to begin to act on knowledge that they preferred not to look at, to wait till the attack took place, to hope the attack wouldn't take place, to do these things quietly, to expel a person without really making it public. The world must, the Western world, the free world, must find a way to cooperate in protecting itself from those who would place bombs and kill the innocent. And it's not going to be easy. But the one thing that we should know is this, that those who do cannot be dealt with in reasonable terms. That Gaddafi has no issue, no cause. He rules a free country. He rules a rich country. He can't claim poverty. He can't claim suppression. He can't claim he's been abused by the capitalists of the West. He's used them to his own purpose. His anger is simply the anger of a megalomaniac who can't always get his way. He's attacked Uganda. He's subverted a government in the Sudan. He's helped to train IRA terrorists and Red Army terrorists, as has Syria. When the Israelis invaded the Lebanon, one of the cache of documents that they found was the documents which detailed the income that the PLO had received for training the terrorists of the world, the Red Star terrorists of Japan, the Red Brigade terrorists of Germany, the IRA terrorists of Iran. All these have been trained in Baalbek and other camps in the Lebanon. There's an international underworld of terrorists, and terror comes from that underworld, and it's bought. It's paid for. The idea of the noble youth striking out for some cause in which he desperately believes is a fancy of the Western media and the Western imagination. There are issues, but these are not issues which create terrorism. Terrorism exists on another base. It exists because people are attracted to violence. It exists because there are cultures which glorify violence. It exists because there are people who like to live with a gun. We have our own history of American mercenaries who've hired themselves out here and yonder around the world. And many of these terrorists are nothing more than mercenaries. It exists because it gives people a sense of power. It exists because many delight to see and to watch the desperate reactions of the world trying to combat their particular actions. I wish I could say to you, as I end this talk, that the American raid on Libya will end terrorism. It will not. I wish I could say to you that terrorism is beginning to fall off. There's no proof that it is. I think we can create a world if we're willing to exert ourselves and to pay the price where terrorists will think twice before they attack, where less bombs will be placed. But I remind you that here in Cleveland, we have a long history of terrorism. I remember growing up and reading the papers as I grew up, day after day after day, of a bomb being placed in some contractor's car or house because he was hiring non-union laborers, or that he was not buying from the right supplier. That's terrorism, the same kind of terrorism that we face in the world. Why is it? I end with this. Why is it that we no longer have the same fear of the automobile that we have of terrorism, that we used to have? Do you remember the time when they used to have on the front page of the paper daily a little box which told you how many people were killed every day in Cuyahoga County and in the state on our highways? And then about 30 years ago, the automobile industry succeeded in getting the media to remove these boxes from the papers. And suddenly the highways became safe, unless someone we knew was one of the statistics. 45,000 people, Americans a year, are killed in our highways. The equivalent of three divisions, full divisions of troops. 45,000 people. But Americans have lost sight of that fact, and we drive with abandon. I wish I could say we drive with care. Now, if somehow the media were to restrain themselves in the handling of issues, events of terrorism, then too we might not be moved so quickly to panic. And so too we might begin to live again with that sense of freedom, control of our destiny, which alone will allow civilized society to sustain itself. We can't give up our way of life. We can't lock ourselves in. We have to live freely, to travel where we will, to go about the world, about our business. Now, I'm not really suggesting that the news of terrorism ought not to be reported. But I am suggesting that it ought to be covered in such a way that the goal is not the sowing of panic, that there's some understanding of the extent of terrorism, extent over time, extent in our terms. And there's a growing awareness, because the media alone can really drive this home, a growing awareness of the simple truth that the proclamation by terrorists of their cause is no justification for indiscriminate violence. The problems of the world will be confronted insofar as they can be confronted. They need to be confronted. But terrorism is self-defeating. The terrorists end creating tyranny, not creating the freedom that they claim to want and to be sacrificing their lives for. I close by reading to you a paragraph or two from a new book by the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Benjamin Netanyahu. The book is on terrorism, and what he says, in a sense, sums up all I've been trying to say to you. The West, he wrote, can win the war against terrorism, and fairly rapidly. I'm not sure of that. But it must first win that war against its own inner weakness. That will require courage. First, government leaders must have the political courage to present the truth, however unpleasant, to their people. They must be prepared to make difficult decisions, to take measures that may involve great risks, that may even end in failure and subject them to public criticism. Second, the soldiers who may actually be called upon to combat terrorists will need to show military courage. It will be up to them to decide whether they can or cannot undertake a particular operation that a government is considering. In the special units of the Israeli army, for example, no one has ever simply been told by the political leadership that you must accept a perilous assignment. The commanders are always asked, is it possible? Do you think you can do it? And if they ever said it could not be done, or even if they expressed doubts, then that would have been the end of the matter. There is also a third kind of courage, the civic valor that must be shown by an entire people. All citizens in the democracies threatened by terrorism must see themselves, in a certain sense, as soldiers in a common battle. They must not pressure their government to capitulate or to surrender to terrorism. This is especially true of public pressure on governments by families of hostages. Such pressure can only be called a dereliction of civic duty. If we seriously want to win the war against terrorism, we must be prepared to endure sacrifice, and even should there be the loss of loved ones, immeasurable pain. Terrorism is a phenomenon that tries to evoke one's feelings of fear. It is understandable that the one virtue most necessary to defeat terrorism is therefore the antithesis of fear, courage. Amen.